of what has become a 4-week series. So we have a bonus week next, because just trying to rush and fit everything in wasn't right, and I managed to fit it for my schedule, so all is good. We started out in week one by talking about Shimshon, Samson, as a unique savior for the Jews, how he fights solo, he doesn't lead an army, he fights on Philistine territory, sparing the Jews from having to fight because they're not ready for that. And the Jews, in turn, make him their shofet. They make him their leader, as Don Isaac Abarbanel explained. We then shifted to talk about Samson as a Nazirite. And we went through the laws of the Nazirite. Normally, there are 3 rules for a Nazirite. Number 1, not to drink wine. Number 2, not to get a haircut. And number 3, not to come in contact with the dead. This is something that normally somebody would vow, man or woman. By default, it's a 30-day period, but one could take a vow like that for life. And we noted that Samson is not a normal Nazirite. The Talmud says he's not a Nazirite, in fact. He happens to have vows that in some ways resemble being a Nazirite, because he's not allowed to have grape products, and he's not allowed to cut his hair. However, he is allowed to become impure, and he also is a Nazirite, not by any vow that he has taken, but rather because of the instruction sent by God to his mother, that she has to observe certain rules before he's born, and then he's going to have to observe certain rules for life. And we asked, why would Samson or anyone become a Nazirite? And we said there's a conventional model, a conventional understanding of what the role of a Nazirite is, and that being a Nazirite is usually understood as a function of restraint. So we talked about the fact that the Torah juxtaposes the rules of the Nazirite in Numbers chapter 6 with the case of the Sota. And we're not going through the whole thing about what a Sota is, but it fundamentally involves a woman and man who have been alone together inappropriately, and there's a suspicion that something happened between them. And the Talmud says that they're juxtaposed in the Torah. That's right before the passage about the Nazirite, to suggest the Nazirite sees what happened to these people and says, you know, alcohol is a major contributor to that, being enamored of one's beauty. And so they take a vow that they're going to become a Nazirite. And we even noted the story that the Talmud brings of a young man who took on the vow of being a Nazirite. And Mickey, I saw you sign in, so I actually had something for you this week. You asked a question in that story that we had about the handsome young Nazirite. He was described as having his hair braided and having beautiful eyes and so on, and you asked about that description and what else it might connote. So I brought you source number 1 on the sheets for this week, and for anyone who doesn't actually have the source sheet, I'm going to post the link in the chat, because I just realized that I have not done that yet this morning, so I'm going to do that, although it was sent out on Monday, but now the link is in the chat, so people can download the source sheet if they don't already have it. But I gave you the verse there from Song of Songs, in which it's actually a description of God. The Jewish people are portrayed as God's beloved, and describing God, they say in this line, his head, God's head is like fine gold, rosho ketem paz in the Hebrew, kivutzotzav tal talim shecharot ka'orev, his hair is braided black like a raven. So God apparently has black hair, although it's worth noting that in the book of Daniel and in other places, God has white hair. So whether that's a dye job, no one is going to say. But the point here is just that the description of the braided hair is the same in the passage here in Song of Songs and in the passage about the Nazirite, this young Nazirite. But in any case, the story that we brought was of a young man who chose to become a Nazirite because he felt that he was out of control. So that's the normal model of the Nazirite, somebody who feels out of control and needs to gain control of himself, of herself. That's all review of what we've said. Any questions or comments on that before we go forward? No, we're good? Okay, or did I accidentally mute people so strongly that they can't unmute? No, I doubt that. Take a look at source number 2, please, on the sheet. That's our opening source for this week, which continues the idea that the Nazirite is somebody who wants to restrain themselves from that which is impure and wants to build up their purification. Sefer HaChinuch is what I'm quoting here. Sefer HaChinuch is a book that was written, as I wrote there, in the 13th century, I believe in Spain. We do not know for sure who the author is. There are theories that have been proposed, but we don't actually know. It's a fascinating work. Literally, what does Sefer HaChinuch mean? Anybody know?
Book of learning.
Book of teaching, book of training, book of education. It was written by the author for his son. And it's meant to provide a summary of each of his 613 commandments. There's a midrash brought in the Talmud that says that there are 613 commandments. And then it was a major sport running from about the 9th century or so until about the 14th century in which various sages tried to figure out how you get to the number 613. The problem is that there are way more than 613 commandments in the Torah, so it becomes a question of how do you count them? What do you do? What do you include? What don't you include? If there are 39 prohibited categories of work on Shabbat, so is that one mitzvah or 39 different mitzvah? Things like that. And the Sefer HaChinuch is an attempt to list the 613 and to give you a little bit of the laws and the ideas involved in each of the 613. It's a great read. It's available in a couple of different English editions these days and very interesting and educational reading. So if you take a look at source number 2, you find his comment on mitzvah number 374. Right? There's a good question if you want to just like stop somebody on the street and ask them, hey, do you know what mitzvah number 374 is? You can really show off by reading this book. There's so much you can gain out of it. So, whenever our intellect can reduce its labor on behalf of the physical, if you're able to channel your mind away from day-to-day maintenance of the body, it's saying, and place as its goal the service of its creator, it will be good for the person. So long as the intellect does not abandon the work of its house entirely, destroying it, for that would also be a sin. As the king wishes to have such a creation, right? It's saying, it's good if you can devote your mind to spiritual pursuits, but don't neglect the body altogether. God doesn't want you to do that. And then he says, this is the sanctity of the Nazirite at his elevated level. When he leaves the service of the physical and he breaks his desires in a way that does not entirely demolish the house, the body, such as avoiding drinking wine and growing his hair, for this humbles the yetzer, the inclination. So it's a means of gaining control of oneself and turning the mind to the spiritual. In a sense, it's a little bit like making oneself a sacrifice to God. That's the conventional model of the Nazirite. So there's no wine, growing the hair, and then, as we said last week, cutting it all off at the end. Perhaps staying away from impurity, because impurity of the dead is a function of mortal existence, and that's what they're trying to stay away from. And it fits the language we saw last week in the biblical text, which speaks of the Nazirite as being sacred to God. So now let's turn to Samson. Why would Samson be given this kind of set of rules of restraint? Why would those be appropriate in particular for Samson, based on what we now know about his career? Right. He was somebody who had these attractions, and this is trying to keep him reined in. Take a look at source number 3 on your sheet. Exactly as Jeanette said, as Rose said, I brought you a midrash, which says, it was revealed before God that Samson would follow his eyes, right? Specifically follow his eyes because he said to his parents as justification for wanting to marry the Philistine woman, she is right in my eyes. And so God commanded that he be a Nazirite. Not to drink wine, since wine leads to impropriety. So we want Samson to stay away from impropriety. That's what the Midrash here is saying. Yes, Rosalind.
And they might just ask, but before we learned that a Nazirite
I mean, I agree with you. He's born into a circumscribed setting in which there's an attempt to keep him in line because we already know he's going to have challenges. But is that really so different from what Judaism, and not only Judaism, society as a whole does in general? We create a framework of laws that are meant, at least in part, to deal with the weaknesses of human beings. And we expect people to, you know, to follow these rules that are meant to protect them from harming others or causing harm to themselves.
But these are very specific rules that are beyond what is circumscribed by society in general, like not taking certain pleasures that we take for granted. So I think he's in a difficult place. He's not, you know, we talk a lot about free will, and he has these things imposed on him, and in many cases, I mean, he's obviously, he struggles with them. And
yes.
He doesn't abide.
Right, and that's where we're going to have to go with this, is this doesn't work. You know, it's great to create a set of rules, but they don't work, right? I see Jeanette's hand and I see Esther's hand. I'm just going to hang on 1 second because I just want to show you in source number 4 an additional source that supports this idea that that's what we're trying to do with Samson. Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, also known as Gersonides, wrote, "And because it was clear and known before the creator of the world that Samson would pursue women and suffer through them, God planned from birth and the womb and conception to prevent it." Which again, as I said to Rosalind, yeah, but it didn't work. You know, the exercise failed. So we have to come back to that. But you're right, Rosalind. He's getting a separate set of rules and not necessarily, and they're not effective. So I'm going to take Jeanette, then Esther, and then Mickey, I see your hand up as well. In general, if people could use those hand things, the automated raise hand, that would be really helpful. It's on your screen. I would tell you where to find it, but I can't because it's not on my screen. Hosts don't have the privilege.
It's not on reaction. Oh, reaction's on reaction.
Yeah, okay. So, sorry, Jeanette. Hang on. Jeanette, then Esther, then Mickey, and then Rose. Go ahead.
I don't usually do this, but on the guide of purpose is in surgery right now, and I wonder if we can very quickly dedicate this year to other guys.
Absolutely.
Say
the name again.
Abigail Esther
Benefrat Zipporah. So for those who don't know, the Burgesses, they're teachers at the school where I'm usually based, and this is their daughter.
And cousins.
So yes, Refuah Shlema, will dedicate learning for her.
Shlema.
Thank you. Okay, Esther.
Okay, so I just want to point out, though, that while we're associating all of these things, all of these Nazarite things with the opposite of the Yetzer, wine is a very important part of our tradition and our mitzvot. And, you know, so it's not just, it's really abstaining from something that is part of, even if you are very pure of soul and you know, and studying all the time, wine is a very important part of our
right. So what Esther is pointing out is a very important point. You might well challenge, if you're telling me that there's a vulnerability to wine, why bother creating Nazarite rules? Why not just don't create wine? Why are you putting this obstacle into the world in the first place? To which the answer indeed is that we view wine simultaneously as an opportunity for growth, as an opportunity for sanctification. Going back a few years when they were drafting the legislation on recreational marijuana use, and at the time there was a big demand for classes about recreational marijuana use. So one of the points that I made in the sessions that I taught then was that on the one hand, the Torah is very against addictive substances and substances that take a person out of their faculties. And at the same time, we use wine to sanctify occasions. We recite Kiddush. We make a blessing on wine at a wedding. We make a blessing on wine at a bris. wine and Purim, since Purim is next week, is a topic in its own right. Those of you who are on my weekly email list for Thursday mornings will be getting, this Thursday morning, you'll be getting my annual screed regarding drinking wine on Purim. But the truth of the matter is that we don't swear off wine altogether. We say that that wine does have a role. However, if a person knows they have a vulnerability, then the opportunity is there to be careful about it. There's more to be said about this. You're 100% right. Mickey, and then Susan, and then Rose. Mickey. What do you mean?
He's obsessive compulsive. Which may have been predetermined, but he has a very difficult choices to make, which are made even harder by the fact that he has this disorder. He is compulsive about his chasing of women and his drinking.
So it's interesting. I mean, I wouldn't apply OCD here because OCD, generally speaking, the compulsion element of OCD is not a statement of this is right in my eyes. It's not even an internal desire. It's felt by the sufferer as an external thing being imposed upon them, and there's a fear of if I don't do this, something bad is going to happen. So I'll take the OCD piece out of it, but I accept the rest of what you're saying, which is this is something, and you're seeing it in the rabbinic texts here, that is viewed as ingrained in him, not a choice. And he's struggling, you know, it's a bit of an odd phrase to use, but with Samson, but he's struggling mightily. And he doesn't appear to be winning. And the Nazirite rules aren't helping either. So this is where I want to go, so what is this all about if it's not going to work? What is this all for? Susan and then Rose. Then you have to unmute. Yeah.
Yeah, I know that's what I was trying to do. I'm just having a little trouble with this whole picture of God. Because first we, in the first thing when we talked about what Abraham and Noah had, we said that we gave God attributes, hair, it was red, or you know.
That was the Song of Songs, yeah.
And God's not supposed to have these attributes.
Correct. Who said he made a mistake? Wait, I didn't say he made a mistake.
No, okay, I correct my wording. We don't understand why if he imposed this on Shimshon, it's not working.
Well, that's where we're going. We haven't, right now we have a problem, which I want to get to solve. We're just
okay,
not there yet.
So why, even with this Song of Songs, we're not supposed to make a shim.
Right, so Song of Songs in general is a parable. It's meant to be a description of a love between two participants representing God and the Jewish people. So the whole point of a parable is that you're using images that don't necessarily apply to those the parable describes. You're trying to create an image that people can understand to describe something that is hard to understand. So you're using things that don't apply to the subject of your parable.
So really,
God doesn't have a head, and it isn't gold. Right. Correct. But the question is, what do you learn from it? When you describe God as having hair that is braided black like a raven, what do you draw from it? And all the commentators on Song of Songs try to explain the symbolism. That's one book that I plan to never teach, is Song of Songs, because I don't understand enough of it. But, okay, Rose, you were going to say.
I was going to say, so in terms of, assuming that we have free will, that God can predict what we're going to do, and he can predict what we're going to be, right? So let's look at this scenario. First of all, he started with the mother not doing alcohol, just because he wants the environment to be alcohol-free, because that was going to be the genetic makeup. Having said that, we do have laws, by them or not abide by them. It's like
So,
I don't see it as a, it was imposed upon him, yes, but because of the fact that it was predicted that this was the gene pool.
Right. I'll say this. You're correct in saying that as a general principle, people are born with certain challenges and flaws. We have rules that are meant to help, and it's up to us to exercise our free will. And in that sense, you could say, you know, God not, you know, succeeding with Samson, so to speak, is a function of Samson, and just like all of us, we're in that position. You could say that, but I want to suggest that that's not what Samson's Nazirut is about. He becomes a Nazirite for a different reason. So what I'm going to do now is proceed with this. We've talked through various ideas surrounding his problems with restraint. What I want to do here is show just how those attempts at restraint don't work, and then float a different model for what it means to be a Nazir. We've already noted the challenge of the party and the haircut for Samson, right? He goes to the party when he marries his Philistine wife, and he's got the 30 guys who are partying with him. We've noted the, of course, getting his hair cut. But in particular, these Philistine women really are inconsistent with what I would have thought we would expect to find in Samson. Now, there's a verse that I forgot to bring on the sheet, which I really ought to have brought there. But it's very, very important, especially as Marlene put the question in the chat, asking why is Samson only interested in non-Jewish women, right? He's involved with two and likely three women in the course of this story, and none of them are Jewish. Now, part of that is because you meet the people you hang out with, and he lives a lot of his life in Philistine territory, so that's who you're going to meet. However, for those who have a Book of Judges in front of them, I pulled one off the shelf here, if you take a look at chapter 14, sentence 4, you find a very important verse. After his father and mother object to his choice of a Philistine woman to be his bride, and Samson says, I don't care, she is good in my eyes, and they specifically say, in the wording of their comments to him, they say, aren't there any Jewish women for you? Why do you have to go look for some Philistine woman? In chapter 4, sentence 3, the text goes, the aviv v'imo lo yadu ki me Hashem hi, ki so anahu mevakesh mi pelishtim. His father and mother did not know this was from God. God was looking for a cause to fight the Philistines. So some suggest that he ends up with, actually, you know what? In source number 7, you can see a piece of it excerpted. It's in my passage that I quoted you from the Talmud, that this is actually foreordained by God, that Samson's going to go this route. Now, first, before we get to that, take a look at source number 5. Rabbi Moses Maimonides insists that the women Samson gets involved with undergo a conversion, if an inferior conversion. Take a look at source number 5 and you'll see what I mean. Maimonides writes, he's talking about Samson as well as Solomon, who engages in political marriages with women from a variety of lands. So he says, do not entertain the thought that Samson, rescuer of Israel, or Solomon, king of Israel, who was called Yedidya, a friend of God, married foreign women when they were not Jewish. Rather, the secret of the matter is thus. The proper mitzvah is that when a male or female outsider comes to convert, we investigate him to see whether he is coming to join the religion to gain money or power or out of fear. And you look to see, are they sincere or not? And because Solomon converted women and married them, and Samson also converted and married them, and it was known that the women pursued this only for benefit and were not converted by a true court, the text viewed them as idolaters, remaining prohibited. When the text doesn't say that these women are Jewish, but instead frames them as not Jewish, it's because they're saying this was a conversion in name, but not in substance. Further, their end demonstrated their original intent, for they served their idols and built altars. That we find with Solomon, that his wives are described as following their idolatry. Jeanette, you're signaling that you're not hearing, or everyone can hear me still?
I'm hearing an echo.
Okay. So what Maimonides suggests is that there was a technical conversion, but it was a very weak conversion. That's one approach to this. Others go even further and say, no, there was no conversion, and that Samson is God's tool. So Don Isaac Abarbanel, I see your hand, Susan. Don Isaac Abarbanel in source number 6 says, we have seen many times in the stories of the prophets that they occasionally acted against the rules so that the service of God would emerge from those deeds. God enabled him, Samson, to do this because even though those activities were in themselves mixed up, vengeance against the Philistines would emerge from them. So now, I really don't understand what you mean when you say that it's for restraint. Because if it's meant for restraint, then God, if God succeeds in causing Samson to be restrained, he won't get involved with the Philistine women, and this whole set of actions isn't going to come to pass. So now God's working against his own purposes. It doesn't fit the story. Susan. Correct. No, that's their point. That's what Maimonides and the commentators are saying. They're saying it's not something that you will find in the text. It's something that they take as a given because it will be inconsistent with the text's presentation of Solomon, for example. How in the world could God call him beloved if we're also going to say that his wives were idolaters who never converted to Judaism?
Because
the text would be entirely inconsistent without it. The text would be inconsistent without it. That's why. Yeah, Rose. So,
that
right.
Means, no, that's like, I've got a real problem because
yes.
God orchestrates that kind of a war.
So, as I wrote in my notes for myself here, yes, this raises free will issues. It absolutely does. If you want more about it, if you look on the top of your sheet, you'll see the first link I gave you is to classes I've given on the book of Judges overall. And there I had a much bigger discussion of the free will issues. I don't want you, though, to spend the time to listen to those thinking that you're going to get a satisfying answer. All you will have, though, is more of a discussion of the problem. I don't want to lure anyone into those classes on false pretenses. But I wanted to point out something really fascinating, or really fascinating to me, anyway. First of all, in source number 7, you get a little bit of an answer to the free will issue. The Talmud that Abarbanel is basing himself on in number 6, when Abarbanel says God wanted him to do it, take a look at number 7. Judges 14:4 says, his father and mother didn't know it was from God, but when he did it, when Samson did it, he followed what seemed good to him. It fits God's plan, but that's not why Samson is doing it. He's doing it because he wants to. But what I want you to know, and what I want you to notice, is the irony in the relationship between Samson and restraint. Because I think this is really important. This is fascinating. I haven't seen anyone comment on it among the classic commentators, but it's totally right. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. You'll see what I mean. Samson only experiences restraint, finally, when he is restrained by Delilah. Meaning, you have a whole series of attempts to restrain Samson beyond being a Nazarite, and they don't work. Take a look on your sheet at source number 8, please. This is the story we read where the tribe of Judah tries to restrain Samson and hand him over to the Philistines. So look at the story. 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cave of the rock of Etam, and they said to Samson, you knew the Philistines rule over us. Why have you done this to us? You're endangering us with the Philistines by attacking them. And Samson replied, as they did to me, so I did to them. This was not about you. This was a personal vengeance thing because they did this to my wife. So they say to him, we have come down to take you prisoner over to the Philistines. And Samson's response is, but swear to me, flipping over to the second side, said Samson to them, that you yourselves will not attack me. You just don't attack me and I'll go quietly. We won't, they replied. We will only take you prisoner and hand you over to them. We will not slay you. So they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. They tie him up with his volition, and then he gets to the Philistine and he snaps the ropes. He's not truly restrained. You can't restrain Samson. That's the idea. And then the next passage in source number 9, you see it again. Samson is with a zonah in Aza, Philistine city. Okay, and again, the story with the zonah, we discussed this the first week. Either she is an innkeeper or she is not. But the more traditional way that people use the word zonah. So take a look at source number 9 at this story. The Gazites, the people of Aza, learned that Samson had come there. How they learned it, we have to come back to. So they gathered and lay an ambush for him in the town gate the whole night. They circled the town. They're trying to restrain Samson. And all night long, they kept whispering to each other, when daylight comes, we'll kill him. But Samson lay in bed only till midnight. At midnight, he got up, grasped the doors of the town gate together with the two gateposts and pulled them out along with the bar, along with the bolt. He placed them on his shoulders and carried them off to the top of the hill that is near Hebron. So you can't restrain Samson. And then again, all the attempts that Delilah makes to restrain him do not work. She asks him, right? See, take a look at number 10. This is from the beginning of the attempts to restrain him. So Delilah said to Samson, "Tell me, what makes you so strong? How could you be tied up and made helpless?" And Samson says to her, "If I were to be tied with 7 fresh tendons that had not been dried, I should become as weak as an ordinary man, and of course it doesn't work." And time after time they try, and you can't, until he finally tells the truth about his covenant with God about the hair. And at that point, they're able to restrain him, and then in source number 11, they brought him down to Aza and shackled him in bronze fetters, and he became a mill slave in the prison. And here's the key. And the Hebrew speakers will appreciate this. The term that's used for a prohibition in the Torah, what's the term for that? When you say something is prohibited, how do you say that in Hebrew? Asur. When someone is chained up and restrained, what's the word for it?
Asir.
An asir is a prisoner? Asur, right? The blessing that's said in the morning, matir asurim, that God frees those who are asurim, who are bound up. The word that is used when they tie up Samson each time they try to bind him is the same word, to be oser him. And finally, the prison is Beit HaAsurim. In other words, all of the restrictions upon him are restraints. All of the things the Philistines do to try to control him are restraints. And he cannot be restrained until he surrenders himself in the end. So, what the message here is to me is this isn't about, he's not a Nazarite to restrain him because it doesn't work and because it would work against God's mission. God's mission is get him into a fight with the Philistines. So I think he's a Nazarite for a completely different reason. And Moish said something close to this in a previous week. And I want to look at what a Nazarite is differently. This is what I think of as the role model of Nazarite, specifically a model for awareness of God. We painted a picture of the sota earlier when we talked about the case in which the man and the woman were alone together inappropriately, right? As a case of a personal failure, right? This man and woman did something that was inappropriate. But there's another component to the story of the sota, and that is that it is a communal incident. The transgression is communal. It affects the couple. It affects their children. It affects their families. It affects their social circle and beyond. If anyone has had the misfortune of being in a community in which such a thing happened, infidelity involving people within the community, you know what I am talking about. It becomes an unbelievably destructive thing for the community as a whole. And even if all that happened was that just that they were alone together and caused people to whisper that things are happening, that in and of itself is immensely destructive. So that the trial, which attempts to prove her innocence, is a public trial. Where does the trial of the Sotah take place? Not just in public. In the Beit HaMikdash. It takes place in the temple. Everybody has to be aware that this is happening, and the language that the Torah uses in Numbers chapter 5 emphasizes the public aspect of this. And that's why this person who becomes a Nazirite sees what happens to her. He sees what happens. And the Nazirite's reaction is not only a personal reaction, it's a public response. The Nazirite becomes a positive role model. We have lots of people in the Torah who are set up as positive role models. The prophet is supposed to be a positive role model for connection to God. The tribe of Levi, located in cities all around Israel, are meant to be role models for the nation. The Nazir, the Nazirite, stays away from the wine and the obsession with beauty that corrupted the Sotah, and so models the behavior for the community. The Nazirite is supposed to be, as we said in the verses we read in a previous week, sacred to God, close to God, trusting in God. That's the idea. And that is key in understanding Samson's role. Paul, I saw your note to me. I'm going to modify that a little bit, but it would probably be next week. It might be this week, probably next week. But it's a good thought. That's the key in understanding his role, and that may be, to go back to a question that I asked last week, that may be why the laws of the Nazirite are found in the Torah. We asked a question. We said, a person can make whatever vows they want and be bound by them. A person can make a vow. I heard before I got on this morning, I heard people talking about drinking tea and drinking coffee and not using a tea bag but using real tea leaves. A person could, I'm not recommending this, a person could take a vow and say, they're not going to have tea, or they're not going to have tea made of bags, or whatever it is, and that's valid. The Torah doesn't give me a structure for all the different kinds of vows. Why did the Torah give me this one? It's not just a model left for people to develop on their own, because God wants to see that there will be people who will take this on for this purpose of being models. It's never going to be mandatory. The voluntary nature of it is important. It only becomes mandatory for Samson, which again is an aberration, which we have to explain. But the idea is for people to recognize a need for it and take it on. And I think this makes a lot of sense in Samson's day specifically. Specifically the time of Samson. The Jewish world of Samson's day is distant from God. They have a tabernacle for God in the city of Shiloh. But no one is going there anymore. I brought you the comment in source number 12. Rabbi Meir Leibush, the Malbim, says the text said, he's on the beginning of the book of Samuel, which is right after this story. It said that no one ascended from Shiloh, only that man ascended. Anybody know who that man is in context?
Elkanah.
Elkanah, right. Elkanah, the husband of Hannah, the father of Samuel. The text said no one else was going to Shiloh. He went to Shiloh. But generally speaking, people were not going to the tabernacle. Further, there's no prophecy at that time. If you take a look at source number 13, also that beginning of Samuel, we're told the youth Samuel served God before Eli. Eli was the high priest. And the word of God was rare in those days. Prophecies were not common. If you were to go back to, I see your hand, Ian. If you were to go back to the story of Samson that we read initially, Judges chapter 13, and you looked at Samson's father, Manoah, and his reaction when they see an angel. This is actually priceless. I should have brought it on the sheet just to show it to you, but I didn't. This is so much fun. Samson's, again, remember how it goes. This angel of God or this messenger of God appears to Samson's mother, Hatzalelponi. She goes and tells her husband, Manoah, what the messenger said. He says, I want to see this. So, sure enough, the messenger comes back once again to her, to Hatzlaponi. And she goes to tell her husband, guy's here, come see. And he goes to see, and they have this conversation with the messenger. And Manoach says, oh no, we're going to die. We saw a messenger of God. And she turns to him and says to him, you know, he just told us I'm going to become pregnant and have a child and all of that. So why do you think we're going to die? She's very cool about it. Like very practical and all that. And he doesn't know how to deal with the situation. But he reflects more the reality of their day. She is the standout. He reflects the way people would respond. They were not familiar with angels and all of that. And we look at the leaders in the period of the judges. You had leaders who were outright murderers. This fellow Abimelech, who killed his half-brothers to take charge. Yiftach is another prize. You had real issues at that point. So that this is a time when you need to have a leader who is going to be dedicated to God to be that inspiration for them. I have more to say about this. I'll pause for a second to take Ian's question.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
Never.
Why doesn't Hashem lay note the following guidance? I think it was Solomon that married an Egyptian Pharaoh's daughter.
Right, we talked about the West Solomon's wives before.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a political marriage.
Yeah, okay. Now we've got Manson getting into, call it modern, warm water with Delilah.
Yeah.
Don't we ever learn a lesson that we should stick to our own?
So, in fact, you can make the argument that the Book of Judges in particular is making that argument. Because over and over again in the Book of Judges, we find Jewish women who are fantastic and do incredible things, and you find them contrasted with the Canaanite women and the Philistine women. Look at Samson's women he's involved with. The first one told his friends about the riddle, causing him to lose all that money until he, you know, killed them. In order to defeat that. Then the second one is this Zonah in Aza, who may have been the one who turned him in, such that they laid an ambush for him. And the third one is Delilah, who ties him up. There is a lesson that's being taught here about the contrast between them. There's more to be said about this theme, but yes, it's a hard lesson, and we don't always pick it up. Rose, I see your hand, but I'm going to actually continue with this, because there's a lot to say here. I could add a fourth week. I can't add a fifth one. So I want to add a dimension to this in terms of how Samson is a role model for faith in God. This comes from Professor Yechezkel Kaufman, lived in the 20th century, in the middle of the century in Israel, and had some very interesting insights, some of which I like, some of which I don't, but very interesting insights on the story of Samson. He points out that the story of Samson is built around imagery which in another culture would look like magic. And it's meant to show you that, in fact, this is not magic, it's actually from God. So you look at the ways that he is restrained in chapter 16. Take fresh tendons that have never been moistened. Take seven of them to wrap them up. She uses seven locks of hair. The whole idea that your strength is in your hair. Like, you'd be very comfortable seeing this in a pagan myth. In fact, there were those who argued that this was somehow tied to pagan myths, although Kaufman does a very nice job of defeating it. But he says it's just the opposite. The point is to make a statement that it's the religious idea, it's God triumphing over magic. You're transforming the image. Take a look at source number 14 from Kaufman. Here we see magical substance change its nature. A magical idea clothed in the form of a religious idea. Beside the magical sign, we find its Israelite translation. Immediately after it says, and his strength left him, it says, because God had left him. And let me now explain what this means, what he's trying to say. If you take a look at source number 15, I put it in bullet points. So much about this story is determined to say God is in charge, and it's all about the religious imagery. He's chosen by God before he is ever born. God's agent is the one who comes to inform his parents of his birth. God is described as the source of his strength. God is the one who commands him to grow his hair in the first place. And when he loses his strength, and this is the point that Kaufman makes, the text doesn't say, because his hair was cut, therefore he lost his strength. The text says God left him, and that's when he lost his strength, which is seen at the end, because his hair regrows, but he doesn't become strong. It's only in the end when he appeals to God and says, I want to take vengeance upon the Philistines, that God says, okay, here's your strength back. It's all put as coming from God. This story is a polemic against turning to magic for help and saying that instead you're supposed to be trusting God. That's what the story of Samson is meant to show. And what we're going to see now in the next part is that for all of his flaws, Samson certainly is a role model for faith in God. Not in the sense that he influences anybody. We don't see outcomes in terms of impact on the nation. But in the sense that he truly lives what he is modeling, even as, yes, he's going with these Philistine women, he models connection to God. He doesn't model restraint, but he models connection to God. And that's where we're going with this, with the next part. But now I come back to the point that a few of you have emphasized. He doesn't have a choice. He's put in this role of being a role model because it was decreed by the messenger from God. He didn't take a vow. His mother didn't take a vow for him. He's simply told. His power and symbolism for the nation actually comes from chosenness. Right? Just like for us. It comes from being chosen. Miriam, to answer your question that you sent me, yes, the answer is he's the only one. He doesn't have a choice about playing this role. He has unique rules, in fact, that prevent him from backing out. We said he's not allowed to repeal his vow. Samson is put in this position because he is needed as a role model for the nation. That's the idea. Someone sent me a message in the chat, even though I keep saying I'm really not monitoring the chat. When I can, I do. When I see something that I want to ignore, then I say, sorry, I can't monitor the chat. The note that somebody sent me was, this is like the book of Esther. Esther being also in this position, not choosing to do so. The difference is that God is mentioned here and not there. And indeed, the book of Judges as a whole is a book that perpetually mentions God running the show to explain natural events. And the book of Esther is the opposite, in which God's name never shows up, even though we look at these events and say, well, those have to be supernatural. They're the flip sides of each other. So on the sheet, I gave you review questions. Why does the Torah present the Nazarite's brand of vows separately from the other vows? You know what? I'm going to skip the review questions because we have 10 minutes left and I want to get started on our last point. Nurit, you have a question. Yeah.
So it's the bits and pieces think that we are in all divided. We didn't come to this degree of kind of abnormality in all aspects.
Yes. So I thank you for pointing this out. The book of Judges is an incredibly depressing read. I actually have a class that's currently going on. We're now in the last chapter. it's just like week after week, you're like, wait, we did what? And then the next week, it's like, huh, what we said last week was nothing. This week, I can't believe we did that. And then it goes on like that the next week. And when I teach the book of Judges, I like to begin with a quote from a friend of mine, Rabbi Yosef Gabriel Bechhofer. His line was in Hebrew, but my translation of it was, there is no book in Tanakh that expresses failure like the book of Judges. It's just, you read these stories and you're like, as you said, shock therapy. It's just like, I can't believe that we did that. And they're our ancestors. But that's the point of the book. The book's message, in part, is a setup for the book of Samuel. To say, we are in need of a king who is going to lead us to righteousness, because the book of Judges shows that when we have the judge system, which is not like a king, it's not an inherited thing, and it doesn't have that stability, it doesn't have the same standard for selection. The judge is not necessarily national, but maybe local. There are a lot of differences between a judge and a king. There's more to really discuss about that, but it just doesn't work. We are in need of the centralized monarchy. Now, mind you, a lot of the monarchs failed also, but they had a better success rate than the judges. That may not be saying something, but that's just the truth of it. So, that's where we are going though in terms of this book. That's the nature of the book of Judges. It's true. We could do a year of the book of Judges instead of these mini series. Yeah, that would be interesting sometime. Maybe we should try that one year. But instead of doing the summary and review questions, I want to introduce our last phase. We talked about Samson now in terms of him being a savior of the Jews and his unique approach. We talked about Samson as a Nazirite, as a role model for the Jews of trust in God. And now I want to get to the third point, which is betrayal and faith in the career of Samson. And here, I have a new toy on Zoom. Some of you were in a class where I used this once before. I learned how to do polls in Zoom. Very exciting. So I'm going to launch a poll. It's an anonymous poll. So you can answer it without feeling like you're betraying yourself here. But the question I'm about to ask you is this. Based on what we have seen so far, is Samson a model of, and it's multiple choice. You can choose as many as you want. I'm just going to mute everybody so that everybody can hear. Is Samson a model of A, trusting God, B, betraying God, C, both, D, neither, or E, uncertain? I'm launching the poll. We'll give everybody some time. Yeah, we'll take, we'll see how the answers come in. But maybe 40 seconds or so for this. Is Samson a model of trusting God? You can betray God. You can give more than one answer. Both, neither, or uncertain? So far, the answers are running heavily towards both. At 30 seconds in, we've had, we've got 62% saying both so far. I'll give it another few seconds. This is a fun toy, the polls. Okay, I ended the poll. I'm going to share the results so you can all see them. We had 37 people responded to the poll, which isn't bad. We have 58 screens. So we've got 14% saying Samson is a model of trusting God, 8% saying he's a model of betraying God, 59% that he's both, 1% said he's neither, and 19% are unsure. So the dominant view is that he's both, and that's something that we'll have to see. Where do we see betrayal in Samson's career? Where do we see betrayal in his story? Don't look at the sources I gave you on the story sheet yet, because that's not fair.
Is he marrying the non-Jews?
Right, he's marrying the Philistine women. Okay, that's one. Where else do you see betrayal? There's a lot more. Right, well, Delilah betrays him. all the women betray Samson. Right, that's true. He betrays God by telling her about his covenant. Myrna, you were going to say? Yeah. Right, there's betrayal with the riddle. Right, the riddle that he tells in the beginning. Also, there's that story where his wife is given away. Right, after that wedding party. Yeah, Rosalind? The tribe of Judah hands him over. Good. Well, not good, but yeah. the tribe of Judah turns him over. One of the things I want to discuss next week was that ethical decision to hand him over. Where is faith in the story of Samson?
Faith.
Where do you find faith? Emunah.
At the end, when he asked God,
right.
That's when he really.
So he shows faith in the end by turning to God for strength. Okay, that's, you know, you could argue that that's a little too little too late. Where else do we find faith in the story?
What about his converting you're saying he converted the wife, that's faith.
Right, minimally, but yes. Claudette, you're putting up your hand, yes. His mother is a person of faith, that's for sure. Thank you, that's a very important point. So what we're going to do is we're going to see a lot of different layers here of faith in the story of Samson. And that's where we're going to go in terms of seeing him as a role model by looking at the layers of betrayal and the ways that he displays faith in God, and particularly how this plays out in the end of his life. We'll see him living and dying as a role model. We have 2 minutes, so I'm going to use them. If you take a look at source number 16, we have layers of betrayal. First of all, Samson and him betraying other people. So in chapter 14, sentence 3, he takes his Philistine wife. And then in chapter 16:17. That's a mistake. It should say 16:17 and 16:26. The haircut, he tells the truth about his covenant with God. And then the next one I'm not sure about. The next one I'm not really sure about. The Philistine youth. At the end of his life, right, when he is being held prisoner by the Philistines, he turns to the youth and says to him, I'm weak, could you lead me to the pillar so that I'll be able to lean on the pillars? And then he uses that to shove the pillars and bring down the building. You could make the argument that this is a betrayal of the youth. The youth had mercy on him, and he used it against them. Now, he's also a prisoner who's being tortured, but wondering if that fits into the theme of betrayal. More often, Samson is betrayed by others. And that's what you see on the sheet in source number 17. He's betrayed with the riddle. His wife is given away, right? Remember that? People forget that part of the story. They give away his wife to somebody else. The Philistines then, when he comes back and he's angry that his wife went away and he burns the fields, the Philistines respond to that by attacking his wife's family. So that's another betrayal, although maybe they thought that he wanted that. Then you have Judah turning him over to the Philistines. The Zonah in Aza turning him over to the Philistines, letting them know that he's there, although we're going to come back to that story because there are other ways to read that. And then finally, the haircut, Delilah turning him over to the Philistines. This is such a story of betrayal. There's so much more to talk about, of course. And that's what we're going to have to come back to next week. But what I hope we got out of this is a sense that Samson's period as a Nazarite may not really be about restraint, but maybe more about him teaching the people about faith in God. His powers come from God, and he's going to emphasize it, and we're going to see that play out God willing, in our bonus week next week. So thank you very much. As usual, I'll stay on for a few minutes to discuss things further. And I echo Jeanette's note in the chat. May God send a speedy refuah shalema, a speedy recovery to Abigail Esther, daughter of Efrat Tzipora, in the merit of our learning today. Thank you very, very much, everyone. So Jeanette suggests the possibility that maybe this is a measure-for-measure thing. Samson betrays others, and Samson is betrayed by others. You certainly can make that argument, that this is a measure-for-measure punishment. It even fits, I didn't point this out yet, maybe we'll get to it next week, that he says, she is good in my eyes, about the Philistine woman, and of course at the end of his life, the Philistines knock out his eyes. So that's going to be part of this. There is a measure-for-measure theme going on in this story. And some of it you could read that way. He betrayed and he was betrayed. But more, we're going to actually see faith with him. It's going to be surprising, but you're going to see it. Effie, and then Claudette. Yes, I'm getting a lot of background noise. If people could please mute when they're not speaking. Thank you. Yes, Effie.
I have a question about the Nazirite thing. Everybody is talking about him not abiding to his rules of Nazirite. Throughout, people have been talking about him drinking. Where does it say anywhere that he was drinking?
Right, so I was careful to say that we don't say, we don't have explicit statements that he drinks. What we do know is that he goes to this massive party where he's got 30 young guys assigned to him, and it's described as a mishteh, which is, by definition, drinking. Literally, shoteh is to drink. So we do not have evidence that he drunk, that he drank wine. We do have evidence about the haircut, but we don't have evidence that he drank wine. That is correct. Right now, the biggest evidence that he's a problematic role model is really the three Philistine women. You know, what about those, Mrs. Lincoln? Okay, Claudette.
Rabbi.
Yeah. You know, Claudette had her hand up, so I'm going to take Claudette, and then Nancy, and then Rosalind. So that is, I think, what you're seeing in the Talmud's read of the passage that said God wanted an excuse to fight with the Philistines. When it's, you know, when the Talmud says, we saw it back in, which one was it? In source number 7, he thought he was betraying God, following what he wanted, but in fact, he's serving the divine end. You can make the argument that that's true for basically everything that happens in our world. You know, there's a plan, God has it, and we do what we do for our reasons, and not recognizing that we're furthering a particular goal. There's a lot to be said for that, although it's really a bigger discussion. But as Jeanette just wrote in the chat, the fact that a person makes a wrong choice and it ends up fitting into God's plan doesn't make it right. He still has to answer for what he did. Nancy and then Rosalind. Right. It is not for you to finish the job.
Finish the task, but now that he's free to desist.
Correct.
And he certainly didn't. He gave it his all at the end.
Oh, yes. Yes, he did. Thank you for pointing that out. Thank you. Rosalind, and then Mark.
To at least
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
That's the end of my speech.
No, but thank you. I really appreciate that because the first time I taught the Book of Judges, first or second time, I don't remember anymore, I remember vividly that as I got to the end, I was crying. He is such there is a lot of depth to him, and his story is fundamentally a tragedy. And not just because he dies in the end, but because of all that, the potential that was there. And on the one hand, what he achieved, and on the other hand, what he squandered. You know? And it's true. He gets a lot of real estate in Tanakh. He's got 4 chapters. That's a lot of text. And even though, as we've noted, we only get, for the most part, a narrow band of his experience, his vendettas, basically. We were told that he led Israel for 20 years, and we don't know anything about what leading Israel looks like beyond these. You're right. He's got layers to him, and it's not simply the human wrecking ball that, you know, that he looks like on first read. And it's not even only the man who can't stay away from Philistine women. There's a lot more going on here with him. I agree with you, and I'm glad that you picked up on it and commented on it. Thank you.
Well, it's like, then I'll finish. It's like other characters, like Jacob, like David. I mean, there are so many layers to them, and many of them are really quite unlikable, and they're human, and they exist in a realm where they're allowed to exhibit their human failings.
There's a long-running dispute in Tanakh study between those who would like to read it as these figures are so close to God that we can't even speak about them, you know, and anything that you see that is negative has to be understood as metaphor or as speaking in extreme terms, but it's not really as negative as it looks, and so on, on one hand. And others who say, let's look at the story that was given to us because it was given to us in this language for us to understand it as it's written. And therefore, let's, you know, if it's depicting flaws, there are flaws. And I think both sides are fundamentally correct. You know, the reality is, if you spoke to God, you are already worlds beyond my religious experience. You know? You know, that's just the way it is. At the same time, if you're going to describe to me that the same person who spoke to God did and fill in the blank for all the people you just mentioned, you know, there's something here to understand, and there's something here that we're supposed to draw from it as the story is written. But it makes for a lot of tension when you read this. And you know, there is one school of thought that says, let's redeem them, and then the other school of thought that says, no, if there's a flaw here, let's read it for what it looks like. And I can't, you know, I think both versions of it have something to offer. But now I'm going to go to Mark, because he's been waiting for a long time.
Thank you. You may have mentioned already, but are we punishing him for the hair? Or was it beyond his control? Or was he put in a compromising situation they shouldn't have been in the first place?
So he put himself in a compromising position. You know, let's be clear about that one. Granted that he says she's righteous in my eyes, and we talk about him being drawn to it and so forth. At the end of the day, yeah, I forget who it was. It was the Lubavitcher Rebbe who somebody wrote to him saying something about in the position in which I find myself, ... And his response was, there's no such thing as a position in which I find myself. You're a human being, you have free will. The point here is that whether we read it as punishment or consequence, he is going to suffer the results of the decisions that he made. That's, you know, that's for sure. And it's not about the cutting of the hair as much as it is about the decision to tell her about it and the covenant that it represents. And we'll see that very clearly in the text, I hope, next week.
By the way,
Yeah, no, that's true. But at least there are ups to go with the downs. In the Book of Judges, you have Devorah's song, that's an up, but really not much else. Rose, and then Jeanette.
Hi,
I'm not getting into the Uriah and Bathsheba story. I refuse to go that route. That story needs a real treatment.
The point that I'm making is that isn't it about humanity? And we have to glean the stories of humanity, try and do the best we can, and then learn from the mistakes as well. Because it's a book about humanity, I think.
And that's one side in the that's one side in the argument. No, it's a legitimate point of view, and I'm not disagreeing with it. At the same time, you know, one of the things that I feel is really important for kids, but also for adults, is that we need to have role models, and we need to have something to shoot for. If a kid grows up in an environment, and you could say this educationally, secularly, religiously, if a kid grows up in an environment in which all their friends are doing the same things they're doing, or less than they are doing, they have nothing to shoot for. You need to have role models. And certainly you need to have the idea that these people are functioning at a different level than we are, or we end up just telling ourselves, I'm fine just the way I am. You need a higher model. So that's an important point. Plus, the same way that we noted, it would be inconsistent to say that Solomon was beloved of God and at the same time married to all of these foreign women who are worshiping idols. There's no conversion at all and so on. It's inconsistent to think that. It doesn't work. It's inconsistent to have stories about, to take King David as an example, somebody for whom God said, I am going to be with him and I keep him from making mistakes, and yet at the same time does this terrible thing. Like, these are things that we have to wrestle with. I'm going to take Jeanette's thing and then I have to go. So, Jeanette, you get the last word.
Thank you. I just love the idea that you have touched upon before. The fact that she was chosen for her, that we should all take that as a lesson, both personally and nationally. She chose us all for something. She gave us all strength, gave us all weaknesses. And what I love about Shimshon is she's making these tiny little decisions. Not what
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we would stay focused in our life, make, you know, the small right decisions as much as possible, and, you know, that would take us to our tough kids, and as a Jewish nation, the same thing.
Right. Thank you. And yes, and the power of each of those decisions along the way, I think, is very significant. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I look forward to next week. Be well.